The thing about huge events like the Wars of the Roses is they often drown out smaller events that happened at the same time. Smaller events that were to people around in the period as big a thing as the actions of, say, the Duke of York or the Queen, but which have been forgotten about with the passing of history. Let me give you an example. There was a merchant from Bristol called Robert Sturmey, and in 1457 he became a huge story many people in the south of England were talking about. Sturmey was one of a new generation of English merchants. They had seen in this decade an erosion of some of the power held by the Italians over trade to the Mediterranean, and he, like others, hoped to exploit it. The year before, he had tried to break into the Mediterranean market with a ship laden with tin and wool and cloth, all staples of the English economy, and it sailed all the way to Pisa to sell them. He did. He earned a lot of cash, and then with that cash, he then sold over to the Middle East, the Levant, and used it to purchase spices. On his way back home, however, his ship ran into a storm and was shipwrecked off the Greek coast. But Robert Sturmey was not one to be put off by such a setback. He'd proven he could do it. And so in 1457, the next year, he started a second attempt, repeating the same process, but this time using three ships. He took much more cargo this time, and he had to be financially underwritten by merchants from across the south. With high hopes, he sailed off, reaching Pisa again, and once again gaining a load of cash there to make a bigger expenditure over on the Middle East coast. Things went well. Sturmey's little flotilla from Bristol filled itself with a cargo of exotic spices, alum, rich cloth, and expensive wine. Their value was estimated to be at least £20,000. The problem was, they never made it home. Somewhere just off the coast of Malta, a fleet of pirate ships fell upon Sturmey's flotilla, and all three ships were taken, leaving 128 sailors dead. And the suspicion was that these pirates had been there at the behest of the merchants of Genoa, who feared the Englishmen may be opening up a lucrative trade route into their backyard. True or not, this was the belief held by many back in England in 1457, and his story was to have an impact in what was going on in England at the time. But as I said, it got lost because most history books talk about armies and nobles, and we forget there are little people around now, and their politics and their passions doesn't always make it into our history books. And I'll explain exactly why that little event about Sturmey becomes important in a bit. Hi there, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, a podcast that tries to tell the chronological history of our city in regular weekly chapters. We are currently involved in the events in London and around the opening stages of the Wars of the Roses, and this episode I make no bones about focusing more upon the city and its internal politics. London was going to have to choose a side, but which side would they pick, and why? So, let's find out. Welcome then to chapter 164 of This Story of London, The Stupid Sexy Pirates of Calais. So, where are we starting this chapter? Well, we're going to go back a few years, just before the end of the last one. And we are going to issue an update on the scorecard. As regular listeners know, I hope every so often I will keep track of events with a short news alert as to the current state of the nation, as during the War of the Roses, this changed a lot. But I'm going to expand it, not only covering the number of separate wars that have taken place and how many times Henry VI has been captured, I'm also going to say how many times the government has fallen. If you think about it, this all started with the protectorate of the Duke of York, who was nominally in charge of England as the king was, you know, kind of being a catatonic lamppost. But then the king woke up, and so the first protectorate ended and that regime fell. And a new regime, headed by the king, was now in charge. And they started acting like the Duke of York was a traitor, and tensions rose. Until eventually, after the Battle of St. Albans, that regime fell. And the second protectorate of the Duke of York was established. This is the third regime so far. This only lasted 4 months. Duke of York resigned. And in February 1556, Henry VI was in charge again, the fourth regime. But come around to 1557, and his wife, Margaret, Queen of England, had basically moved the king into Coventry or the Midlands region. He probably had another attack of his mental illness going on, and this established what was in effect the fifth regime to be in charge of the country, as she was clearly in the driving seat over her husband. And so, with this in mind, War of the Roses scorecard, February 1557, updated edition. Number of wars, 1. Number of times Henry VI has been captured, 1. Number of regimes, 5. Current regime, Queen Margaret of Anjou basically running things in the name of her husband, Henry VI. Last chapter we covered the affairs in this year, where the city had elected the seemingly very Yorkist Thomas Canning as mayor. To Henry and Margaret, it appeared that if the city of London was violently swaying towards the Yorkists. As we know, however, from the actions of Canning and later Mayor Boleyn, London was actually trying to be neutral, but the regime did not see Canning's election that way. They responded to his election at first with a sulk. The two members of the Grocers' Company who had received patronage from the royal court, Richard Hackady and William Ansell, and regular listeners will hopefully remember them because I mentioned them a couple of chapters ago, well, they lost their royal patronage. And the tax revenue they'd been gaining from the state now went to a man called William Godfrey, the royal apocrypha and a yeoman of the King's Chamber. This sent out a sign to the Grocers' Company of London that they could expect a hostile reception in court, who suspected them of supporting the Duke of York now, even if they were trying to keep their options open. And that also sent a signal that the grocers could expect no help in fending off the Italians' encroachment onto the market of London and England. As we covered last chapter, with the attempt to murder the Italian merchant Galliard Scott and other Italians in Lombard Street, and the way Mayor Canning just managed to prevent this, coupled with the riots the year before and the city being very tense and on the verge of violence, actually saw the masters of several livery companies being called to stand bail for their servants and apprentices, not just the mercers, who were threatening violence upon Italians. And while it had been Galleon Scott who had been the chief target of the conspirators because he shipped wool by royal license to Zealand, the city had become so hostile to Italians that they, as a community, decided that maybe they should leave London and set up base in Winchester or Southampton. They actually began renting houses in Winchester. But the Italian migration out of London did not happen. They did not set up in Southampton, and the reason for this was due to one London grocer, a man called John Payne. And what he was doing is indicative of just how influential the rich oligarchs of London could be. John Payne, as we said, is a member of the London Grocers Livery Company. But he was one who had developed over the years a plethora of contacts and friendships in the port of Southampton. And with the political crisis gripping the nation, he saw an opportunity to create his own faction of pro-London civic leaders in Southampton. See, in the port, Payne's local rivals politically were led by men like Walter Fettyplace. And these were people who had developed substantial trade links with the Mediterranean because they were partners with the Italians. And being partners with the Italians meant they could put their people on Italian ships, and that meant they could bring back to Southampton spices, dyes and alum. Fettyplace and his other local merchants had been behind using this to expand the influence of Southampton in the distributive trade, aka who sold expensive foreign goods away from the ports in the mainland and inner parts of England. London had traditionally dominated this market in the past, but now goods from Southampton were being carried as far north as Northampton and Chesterfield. Ever since the Venetian merchant Janus Imperiale had first planned to make Southampton, rather than London, the chief centre of Italian trade in England, Southampton had become London's most dangerous internal rival towards international trade. And if they could control the distribution of Italian imports of raw materials for the English cloth industry, they could also draw themselves a return trade in exports of cloth for the Mediterranean. This business is a zero-sum game. If Southampton rose in wealth and influence, London would fall in wealth and influence. So as you can imagine, for members of the London's Grocers Company, you would want to see Southampton stay in its lane and act as an overflow for London as opposed to a replacement for London. And this is why not only did John Payne gravitate towards gaining influence in the town, but many in London's Grocers Company backed him. If Payne and his associates could get a dominant position in Southampton, he could, like the Canning family in Bristol, be relied upon to maintain the status quo between all the trade ports in the south of England. Payne's plan was simple. In return for him getting a decent share of London's export and distributive trade, it was to be expected that he would safeguard the Grocers Company's interest in the port and see they were not undermined by the ambitions of rival merchants. Now, Payne was not acting alone. Other London grocers joined him, John Walker, Thomas Holman, and Richard Walker, John's brother, and their aim was to restore Payne to a position of power down in Southampton by galvanising the supports of the residents of the town who did not share in the Italians' favour. Payne was basically going all out to prevent Southampton from becoming the headquarters of the Italians in England, and in 1457... he was responsible for seizing a consignment of Woden wine belonging to a Venetian merchant called Jacob Feleron. And doing this then had repercussions in London, as Feleron became a member of the Drapers' Company. Some of London's drapers had begun to acquire close links with the Genoese down in Southampton. The rich draper, Thomas Cook, was a significant importer of woad, so it could have been that the Italians were going to use the drapers to fight the grocers to prevent Payne from getting control in Southampton. But it's about now that news arrived of the unfortunate fate of the Bristol merchant Robert Sturmey, who I started this chapter talking about. And when that news arrived, Payne was able to capitalise it to push his anti-Italian agenda. Sturmey had many investors back in England. 26 of them came from Bristol, but 5 of his backers were Londoners, London-based grocers. One of them was John Young, and John Walker of Southampton, the associate of John Payne, was another. These men of wealth were able to feed the rumours that the Italians, especially the Genoese, had sent the pirates to attack Sturmey and his men just to prevent the English merchants trading in the Mediterranean. The public outcry against the Genoese, which followed the destruction of Sturmey's ships, basically forced the crown to move against them. All the Genoese in London and Southampton were imprisoned, and Payne was able to prevent the Italians from all leaving London and moving to Southampton. Eventually, the Italians would have to pay the crown £6,000 before they were freed. And there had been an order to confiscate all their goods as well, much to the delight of the grocer's company, but let's just take a moment and step back. London's grocers obviously wanted the Italian merchants who came to England curtailed and limited, but these Italians had one weapon they could play and did play. They could pay hard cash to the king to allow them operate. And the crown was always susceptible to Italian bribery. It had been since the days of Edward I. And by August 1458, the crown had countermanded the order for the confiscation of Italian goods. And it was clear that the crown did not and would not side against the Italians. There was a vigorous attempt by Queen Margaret to recover power for her court and to raise money and men for her cause. And the easiest way she could get money was from merchants from the Mediterranean. These guys didn't care who was ruling over who, they just wanted to trade and paid cash. So she found herself incredibly biased towards them. And right in the middle of all of this, London's politics was rocked by a small but powerful scandal. One that sure as hell seems that Queen Margaret was trying to screw with the city and go after the leading Yorkists in it in a sly but subtle way. See, after the riots against the Italians, which we covered a couple of chapters ago, a long drawn-out inquiry was conducted at the Guildhall into all kinds of commercial frauds and evasions of the official regulations of the city. The Italians were originally the main target of all of this. And it seems clear that the early prosecutions were all inspired by those merchants of London who made their money running the wool monopoly out of Calais, the staplers faction. In some cases, the evidence supplied to this inquiry was given by the mayor of the Calais staple himself in person. However, in December 1457, there appeared, before this inquiry, which was being conducted at this point by Mayor Boleyn, now helped by an official of the Exchequer, the notable figure of Alderman Thomas Canning, the mayor from the previous year. He was suddenly charged with shipping 272 sacks of wool in the name of three Italian merchants over to Zealand, which was contrary to the regulations of the staple, which said you could only ship wool to Calais. Thomas Canning did not attempt to defend himself. He just pissed off and bought a pardon from the king. Canning's name does not appear with John Young's amongst London's wool exporters to Calais in surviving customs records. He does not, therefore, seem to have had a personal stake in the wool staple. He clearly comes across as a man with trading connections with the Netherlands and was exporting cloth there as far back as 1439. He was also dealing substantially in wool and cloth as a middleman. So even if these charges of evading customs had been fabricated, there can be no doubt from the haste in 1458 with which he bought a pardon from the king, that he was guilty of deliberately evading the regulations of the staple the year before. In the eyes of the staplers of London and many others, former Mayor Canning was now revealed as a traitor. And the consequence of this was that it caused a rift between all those who were supposedly allied to the Yorkist cause. The revelations about Canning were so perfectly timed, so ideal for the royal court to exploit, that for me it's impossible to avoid the conclusion that they were part of a carefully designed information campaign coming out of the Royal Exchequer to create division and embarrassment for the Yorkists in London. Inevitably, it's probably caused the rift between Thomas Canning and his half-brothers, John and Thomas Young. And this family rift helps explain why, from 1457, Thomas Canning became unreliable in his political allegiance and in his loyalty to his family. In the eyes of the court, London had either to be intimidated into neutrality, won over to the royal cause, and if they refused, they could play London's own internal politics upon it. And London was having some interesting internal politics at this time. The Drapers responded to the hostility of several grocers and mercers by admitting 23 prominent Italians to their membership, and in doing so, seemed to ally themselves closer to the court. On paper, many of London's merchants, of course, always wanted to support the existing government while it was in power. But their problem was Margaret had moved the royal court to Coventry in the Midlands, and they weren't doing much, and it was raising doubts as to its stability. As we mentioned last chapter, in 1458, and more seriously in April 1459, there were riots involving the inhabitants of Fleet Street and the lawyers resident in the neighbourhood, in which many were killed and wounded. The king actually threatened to suspend the city's franchise if these riots did not stop. The alderman of the ward in question, the grocer William Taylor, who was also then the alderman of the grocer's company, was arrested and actually imprisoned in Windsor over this. Now, whether he was thrown in jail because there was a genuine concern about the Fleet Street riots, or whether he was thrown in jail to send a warning to the grocers' company to give its full support to the king or else, it's impossible to say. But it sure as hell feels like the king, and more realistically the queen, was piling the pressure on London. And you want further evidence of this? Fine. By the middle of 1459, we see a stream of prosecution of London merchants for giving illegal credit. Now, let's put this into perspective. In the 4 years before 1459, there had been a grand total of 8 people prosecuted for giving illegal credit. Period. During the Trinity and Michaelmas terms in 1459, no fewer than 104 cases were heard, almost all of them presented by the king's attorneys. Of the 93 London merchants accused of giving illegal credit, 69 of them were Londoners, and the rest were country woolmen and clothiers linked to London merchants. Now, I have read arguments by some historians that do suggest that these court cases were brought about by the Crown desperately needing to raise cash by any means possible, and that was their motivation. But these cases combined only raised £128 for Henry VI. No, in my opinion, this is political. The Queen was increasing the pressure on her perceived enemies amongst the Londoners. The suspicion, I feel, is strengthened by the fact that the first grocer who was prosecuted in June 1459 for giving illegal credit was John Young, and within a month he was followed by John Payne. Young picked out because, you know, he does have Yorkist links, and Payne because of what he was doing down in Southampton. William Leeming, Young's close associate and a prominent woolman, was another grocer who was prosecuted, and also was John King, one of the wardens of the company. In total, 9 members of the grocer's company were accused of giving dodgy credit, along with 10 mercers and 25 drapers. Now, most of the people who were charged could just buy a pardon, but that wasn't the purpose. The purpose was the Queen laying down the pressure upon the city. And the prominent supporters of the Queen within the grocer's company, it should be noted, escaped scot-free. It was their political rivals who suffered. But this campaign seemed to work. It clearly intimidated most of the less committed merchants of London, including the grocers. We start seeing new members of the company arrive, and they were being brought in because of their known link to the Crown, including Sir William Pesce, and they accommodated Thomas Brown's royal court connections. By the autumn of 1459, Margaret seemed to be on the verge of cowing London. But then events elsewhere took over. And what were the events elsewhere? So, as I covered last chapter, we see that from late spring and to the early summer of 1459, both the Duke of York and the Queen were beginning to prepare once more for armed conflict. And last chapter, I said the Queen had decamped to Westminster. I got that wrong. She'd migrated to Coventry. And it was a non-attendance there of the Duke of York and the Nevilles and their supporters which had led Queen Margaret to openly condemn them. It seemed inevitable that the next step would be for the government to declare the Duke of York and the Earls of Salisbury and Warwick as traitors. And after that, a bill could be introduced to Parliament to have them attainted, which would see them and their families stripped of all their lands and titles and reduce them to nothing. And in the case of the Duke of York, this would see him actually lose his status as a member of the royal family. It was clear, right here and right now, a new fight was inevitable. On September 20th, 1459, the Earl of Warwick returned from Calais, gathering several hundred men about him as he rode via Warwick Castle to meet his father, the Earl of Salisbury, and the Duke of York at York's base in Ludlow in the Welsh borders. Salisbury also set off, having recruited perhaps 5,000 men. And as he set to ride south from the family seat of Middenham in Yorkshire, the truth was right now armies were in the field. London and the rest of the country watched in horror as a much larger scale conflict seemed just about ready to erupt. News of the Earl of Salisbury and his army soon reached Coventry, and the court dispatched James Turchett, the Lord Audley, to attempt to intercept Salisbury's army. Audley was a veteran of the wars in France and a powerful Midlands lord. He was able to raise a large force from his lands in Cheshire, Staffordshire and Shropshire, and soon he was leading an army numbering somewhere between 8 and 12,000 men. And at the heart of this was a bristling cavalry, knights bestowed in glory, blessed by the Queen, fully armed and armoured. And a much larger cavalry force than Salisbury had at his disposal. On the morning of the 23rd of September, Audley marched his men along the road that ran between Newcastle-under-Lyne and Market Drayton up in Shropshire. His scouts reported to him that Salisbury's army was ahead. To block the Nevil, Audley drew his men up in a battle formation at a place called Blore Heath, a large open pasture of sloping ground with a light wood on one side and a small stream known as Hemplin Brook on the other. It was behind this stream that Audley's force now stood, their front perhaps a mile long and partially defended by a thick hedgerow. The Earl of Salisbury turned up, saw this, and organised his men opposite them on the slope, their front only about at most two-thirds as long, but their lines were quickly well defended. Salisbury put his archers in front of them, but they stood protected by a deadly forest of sharpened stakes hammered into the ground, a classic device for rather upsetting onrushing cavalry. And on his flanks, Salisbury and his men were sheltered by a wood on one side, and on the other they formed a little bastion of wagons which they had brought all their kit together, and they'd been chained together to make a barricade. The two sides prepared the ground, and they both knew this was it. All the politics was over. A new war was starting. Queen Margaret against York and his allies. And the first blows were going to be struck right here and right now. Well, Salisbury steadied his men. He knew he was in trouble. Not only was he outnumbered perhaps 2-1, by now his scouts had come back to tell him that there were two additional royalist armies nearby. The Queen herself was waiting less than 10 miles away in Ecclesall with a second army just as big as this, and a third army under the command of the Stanley brothers. Lord Stanley and Sir William Stanley hung back somewhat closer, apparently awaiting royal commands to intervene and join Audley's side. That morning, the two opposing armies both took defensive positions, waiting for the other side to strike first, not wanting to be the ones who cast the first blow. But Salisbury realised time was not on his side, and so, just about midday, he decided to start the dance. He ordered his men to begin to undo the barricade made up of the wagons and to recouple the horses to the wagons and to give the impression that he was about to retreat. This was a feint. And Audley took the bait. He immediately sent his cavalry out to attack and chase down the retreating Yorkists. Unfortunately, in order to get to Salisbury's men, the cavalry had to cross that brook in front of them. And as they waded through the water, their pace slowed down. Salisbury ordered his archers to move forward. Arrows rained down upon the cavalry, sending men flying from their horses and making horses collapse under the weight of blows. Any knight who fell from his horse and made it somehow to the bank were then cut down by small forces of infantry set forward just for this purpose. The cavalry retreated back to the safety of their lines, leaving death behind them. Audley was indignant at this, and he ordered a second charge across the river. And the same thing happened. His cavalry were cut down in large numbers. At this point, the army of the Stanleys, which was waiting close at hand, and who should have been expected to come help, well, the Stanleys were pragmatists, if we're going to be honest. And Thomas Lord Stanley just decided to keep his troops back, just in case. And his brother Sir William Stanley actually sent reinforcements to Salisbury side, you know, just in case. In the end, Audley decided he had no choice but to completely change his tactics. He got told everybody to get off their horses and led about 4,000 of his men, including a large number of dismounted knights, to advance on foot. The two sides finally came to blows and a ferocious hand-to-hand battle began. Audley led his men personally, and this meant that he was there in that open field that he was hacked down and killed, and his assistant commander, John Sutton, the Lord Dudley, was taken prisoner. The Loyalists had lost their leaders and immediately gave up the fight. The battle had lasted about 4 hours in total. And by the end of it, perhaps 2,000 men lay dead in the field. The Battle of Blawhith had seen a new war start, and the first victory to the Duke of York. The Earl of Salisbury may have won, but the victory had cost him a lot of men and had depleted his forces. As he went to march south to carry on his way, he decided to send back a large number of his remaining forces under his two sons, Thomas and John Neville, to secure their holdings back north. And alas, they were captured soon after. Meanwhile, as Salisbury marched south, the larger royalist armies under the Queen now consolidated their forces and followed, dogging the Earl the entire way. When Salisbury finally met up with the Duke of York and his son, the Earl of Warwick, they realised that the army bearing down on them outnumbered them 3-1. Queen Margaret had her shit together and they were in trouble. After a brief recommitment to each other's causes in Worcester, the three lords and their small army retreated to the castle of Ludlow, where they originally intended to get to. They sent letters asking for mediation, but after Blawhith, the time for talking was over. Word came back from Margaret's court the rebellious nobles had less than a week to surrender and beg for pardon, feeling that they would die if they were captured. The three men refused. By the second week in October, the rebel army was now camped in fields south of Ludlow Castle. Next to them on the high ground sat the Ludlow Castle itself, bristling then as now with a myriad of towers and high battlements, above which flew the Duke of York's standard. To its side and its south, the River Teme swirled, a thick, fast-flowing river, and that only had one route across it, into the town, a recently constructed bridge called Ludford Bridge. And here, just below that bridge, on the south bank, York, Warwick and Salisbury drew up their forces together. But their morale was fading, and the men were close to panic. And on the 12th of October, the Royal Army arrived. It was massive. It was commanded by Henry the Duke of Somerset, Humphrey the Duke of Buckingham, and Henry the Earl of Northumberland, and included the Duke of Exeter and the Earls of Arundel, Devon, Shrewsbury and Wiltshire. This force was the force of England, royal nobles of all types and ilks coming to join together to send out a clear political message. Right now, in their eyes, York and his allies were not legitimate rebels with genuine grievances. They represented a petty, partisan faction. worst of all, was back from this line, was the Queen and the King himself. Many of the men who had marched out under the Yorkist banners had been told they weren't going to fight against the King, they were fighting for the King, against his bad nobles. But now they realised they may have to bear arms against the King himself. Panic began to set in. Facing these odds, as the sun began to set, York ordered his cannon to fire towards the Royalist lines. But this was merely a welcoming salvo. All knew the next morning, on the feast of St. Edmund, coincidentally the birthday of the Prince of Wales, that the fight would begin in earnest, as a cannon would fire now and then. One of the captains of the Earl of Warwick, a veteran of the tough Calais garrison called Andrew Trollope, decided he wanted no part of fighting against his king and got himself and his veteran Calais troops out of the mess. They crossed the lines in the darkness and surrendered and offered invaluable information of the disposition of the Duke of York's forces. As the news of this arrived back to the Duke of York and his fellow nobles, they knew they were doomed. And so they made the only decision they could make. They fled. There in the cold, harsh shadow of night, they sneaked back to Ludlow Castle and then, minds made up, fled into the darkness of the English countryside, leaving their army stood where it was. From Shropshire, they scattered, quote, into diverse parts, beyond the sea, more for the surety of their persons, unquote. York and his son, the Earl of Rutland, made for the Welsh coast, breaking bridges as they went, before taking boats across the sea to Ireland. The Nevilles, meanwhile, fled in great peril to the West Country, taking with them young Edward, Earl of March. From Devon, they took a ship to Guernsey, and from there they returned to Warwick's Haven in Calais. Their army woke that next morning expecting a terrible battle and now found themselves deserted and quickly surrendered and begged the Queen for forgiveness. Queen Margaret, located as she was behind the Royal Army, must have felt a great sense of vindication. 4 years after the defeat of the Battle of St. Albans, here her enemies had been scattered. As a contemporary writer said at the time, quote, every lord in England durst not disobey the Queen, unquote. She spared the soldiers who York had led to this, but she allowed her army unleash hell upon the town of Ludlow. Punishments would be meted out, even if the victims were not guilty of anything. The royal troops broke into the town and began its slow sack. Eventually, men would stagger drunkenly about the streets, having robbed taverns off their, quote, pipes and hogsheads of wine, unquote, while others looted themselves to household goods. Many defiled local girls and women. This was a scene that would be repeated all across the kingdom in the coming months, as Yorkist properties and communities were despoiled and their tenants harassed. Ludlow, quote, was robbed to the bare walls, unquote. War of the Roses scorecard, September 1559, updated edition. Numbers of wars, 2. Numbers of times Henry VI has been captured, 1. Number of regimes, 5. Current regime, Queen Margaret of Anjou has basically won and is now going to crush the heads of her enemies. And after this, the Queen moved against her enemies, powered almost entirely by spite. Now, that's not a judgment on her alone, because she wasn't alone. The entire conflict right now was reduced to what was in effect a series of personal vendettas. And we've been seeing this across England for a few years. The nobility off the land had been reduced to vicious bloodletting and acts of petty nastiness upon one another. So the Queen indulging in this doesn't say anything about her character, apart from the fact she was being the spirit of her peers. She summoned a parliament to St. Mary's Priory in Coventry, and there intended to use the law to destroy the Duke of York and his allies by passing Acts of Attainder. And that gathering became known as the Parliament of Devils. Now, London did send a deputation to that parliament, led by William Morrow, to assure him of their loyalty and support. Remember, they'd just been having the crap kicked out of them by the Queen unleashing some vicious internal politics on them. Smiling ain't nice to the King, boys. Smiling ain't nice to the King. What the London delegation would have seen, however, was not good. The penalty of being attainted was the equivalent of suffering legal death. It stripped its victims of all their estates and titles, including, quote, all honours, castles, lordships, manors, lands, tenements, rents, reversions, annuities, offices, fees, advowsons, fee farms, inheritances, and other possessions, unquote. The victorious King and Queen aimed this not only at the Duke of York and his sons, Edward the Earl of March and Edmund the Earl of Rutland, but also at Salisbury and Warwick and their noble supporter John Lord Clinton. They also went after other Yorkist supporters, servants, retainers and associates. You had men such as John de la Pole, who'd inherited the title of Duke of Suffolk from his rather cursed father, and he was demoted from Duke to the rank of Earl for the crime of simply being married to the Duke of York's daughter, Elizabeth. It was like that. And this Parliament also had orders for London. It had to cease all trade with Calais. See, the Earl of Warwick had returned there and was rapidly seeking to make Calais the new base for the losing Yorkist faction. Obviously, the regime wanted to drive them out. And so they issued an edict to London that prohibited all trade to and with Calais, which also included the compulsory wool market, which was run by a cabal of London's richest wool merchants, both grocer and mercer, the Staple. This decision to ban the Staple proved to be a huge mistake on behalf of the Queen. The wool merchants of London had been antagonised and intimidated by the unrelenting campaign of nasty politics that I just covered earlier on. And they'd been further antagonised by the King granting a monopoly of trade with the Mediterranean for 1 year to the Italians, who were financing him, and by renewing their licences to evade the Staple. Now they had cause to fear that the Staple itself would be moved from Calais. The Parliament of Devils started to actually drive London into the arms of the Duke of York's faction. And the Duke of York? Actually, he and his followers were regrouping. See, while the Queen was destroying the Duke and his followers legally, the actual men themselves were beyond her reach. The Duke of York and his second son, Edmund, were safe in Ireland. And any attempt to replace him as the Lieutenant of Ireland was backfiring. The Irish provided him with a force of archers to take to England if he wanted, and they allowed him to issue his own coins, and the lands that were English in Ireland were refusing to accept the authority of any Privy Seal coming from England. But the real centre of the resistance of the Queen was to be found now in Calais, where the Earl of Warwick now offered safety and shelter for any back in England who had to flee the royalist spite and viciousness. Richard Neville, the 16th Earl of Warwick, was now age 31. He was a veteran warrior, general and admiral. He was highly regarded as a natural leader. He'd shown he had enormous political skills, because the moment he turned up in Calais, he started recruiting allies from the European nobility, including the Duke of Burgundy, and he managed to bring round to his way of thinking envoys from the Pope. With his father, the Earl of Salisbury, and with his nephew, York's son Edward, Earl of March, Warwick had spent his time since fleeing Ludlow in Calais regrouping, rearming, and striking back. Henry Beaufort, the Duke of Somerset, was sent by Queen Margaret to throw out the rebels and to take Calais for her. Somerset managed to capture the outlying fortress of Guines. And there, as a real screw you buddy to the Earl of Warwick, he appointed the captain who'd fled Warwick's forces back in Ludlow, Andrew Trollope, to be bailiff of it. But Somerset was unable to make any additional headway. Warwick's forces kept beating back his men, and all efforts to reinforce Somerset were anticipated and frustrated, and he was finally forced to surrender after defeat by Warwick at Pont de Nudelet on the 23rd of April 1460. You see, the Earl of Warwick's real power right now was that he had become a pirate. Now, let's get something right here. We have this image that pirates are a thing from the 17th and 18th century, right? You're all swashbuckling and buccaneers and Sir Francis Drake. Well, England was actually famous for its pirates before that, right here in the 15th century. English pirates on the English Channel had been suppressed very brutally by Henry V, with a ruthlessness unequalled by any medieval king before or since. But the pirates had come back very quickly after Henry V died. In the 15th century, English pirates, especially from the West Country, were savage, brutal, and very successful. From Dartmouth, you had men like John Hawley the Elder and John Hawley the Younger. From Poole, you had Henry Pay. From Rye, William Long. Plymouth, Richard Spicer. Kingsbridge, Thomas Gill. And Foley's Mark Mixtow. They were known and feared throughout all the ports in Northern Europe. And what had been going on is at home, they enjoyed the backing of prominent men of their county. You couldn't really complain about English pirates to the royal officials or justices or jurymen of the ports, because most of these guys were either themselves joining in the piracy or were investors in the pirate raids. And these guys suddenly found themselves welcome in Calais. And this combination of circumstances meant that the Earl of Warwick now had a true force majeure for any future conflict in England. He was now controlling a large army and navy. I mean, the garrison in Calais and the Pale of Calais was the nearest thing to a standing professional army in England. There were 260 men in the town's garrison. There was another 50 for the castle of Calais, permanently based there, and another 18 permanently based in Rispon Fort, which guarded the harbour. The Calais Pale had a couple of forts, which were also garrisoned with 100 men in Guines, and about 41 at a fortress in Hames. In addition to this force, Warwick had acquired a locally recruited force of about 300 men, plus a further 200 men who belonged to the retinues of the captains in the town and the Pale. And these were answerable just to him. So this is a standing force of about 1,000 men. But to this could be added the unknown number of privately hired soldiers of the Calais merchants and officials. For example, Sir John Paston hired 4 archers out of his own wages, and they wore his livery. But remember, when we say Calais merchants, we have to include the merchants of the Calais staple, the compulsory wool market from which most of the town's revenue came from, and whose masters were a cabal of grocers and mercers back in London. It allowed them to hire armed men who technically came under the title of the garrison of Calais, hence the seizing of a ship, which we mentioned last chapter. And what must be understood is these were not men raised by their local lord. These soldiers were professionals. They were veteran of the still ongoing 100 years plus war with France. They were experienced and they were highly paid. The standard wages of the men in the garrison was about 8 pence a day, which amounted to a yearly salary of about £12.15 and 8 pence per year for a man-at-arms or a mounted archer. And to put that in scale, the annual income of £10 a year was considered sufficient to allow you to live the life of a gentleman. So these men were expensive and well paid, and would only have gained that amount of salary if they were worth it. In short, as captain of Calais, the Earl of Warwick had at his disposal a force that could be used to exert considerable military power over England. And now to this he added sea power, his pirate fleets granting him naval control of St. George's Channel and the English Channel. This allowed the senior partner in the rebellion, the Duke of York, to send communications between the exiles and to plan their next stage with almost total impunity. Like the ancient Anglo-Saxon state or that England during the Norman era, the island was now a sitting duck. The rebels used this advantage well. They sent letters and placards into Kent and elsewhere on the coast, expounding their claims that they were entirely loyal subjects of King Henry who could do himself no wrong. Their aims were to rid the kingdom of traitors, to end the prostitution of the crown, to free the land from the intolerable burden of incompetent, corrupt government. Meanwhile, piratical pro-Yorkist pirates arrive like Vikings on the beaches of Kent, attacking towns and kidnapping or murdering royal officials. Warwick's men sailed over to England, found ships the state were planning to use to sail against Calais, and took them back. The Queen was furious. She ordered Lord Rivers, Richard Woodville, and his son Anthony Woodville to go to Sandwich and assemble a fleet with instructions that they were to launch an attack upon Calais the moment they could get the ships. In January 1460, Warwick's men sailed over, kidnapped these two, and seized the entire royal fleet, and then sailed back to Calais. And London cheered. Of course London cheered. The Calais pirates were helping Warwick pay for all these men and crews by raiding Genoese and Spanish shipping in the English Channel. London didn't want to pick a side. They wanted to stay neutral, but it was hard. Those stupid, sexy pirates of Calais were beating up foreigners. Once again, opinion in the city shifted, buoyed by Yorkist success. Yet at this point, even now, I honestly believe that London was trying its hardest to stay neutral. But really, the final nail in the coffin came on the 13th of February, 1460. See, back in June 1459, as I said, the Genoese had been given safe conduct to renew their trade with England. But a rumour went out that the Crown was considering a treaty of alliance with Genoa. I mean, of course they were. Warwick and his stupid, sexy Yorkist pirates were dominating the sea. A treaty with Genoa could gain the King some naval power, right? London became paranoid. Would the King and his Queen actually do this? The Grocers' Company paid a clerk at Guildhall to search for a document to do with this proposed treaty. And we see from their records that shortly afterwards, they paid for the writing of, quote, a certain thing for the king, unquote. Which, as far as we can tell, was them begging the king, don't do this. However, the treaty with Genoa was signed on the 13th of February 1460, and its contents only confirmed the fears of London as a city. For the next 4 years, the Genoese were free to trade anywhere in England and could ignore any existing rights belonging to London. Royal policy had united the fears of distributive merchants like the drapers with monopolists like the staplers. And all sides in London's mercantile and business class realised that they're going to have to look to the Yorkist lords at Calais for some kind of alternative government that would protect their interests. As we enter 1460 then, London firmly swings to the side of the Duke of York. And boy, is that going to have serious consequences. And I'm going to leave it there. Thanks for listening. If you went out to Carnival this week, I hope you enjoyed it. Regular listeners will know I'm a big fan of Notting Hill. Anyway, I do hope you're all okay. You had a lovely week. Looks like the weather's turning and the rain's coming. Oh well, autumn's on its way. Thanks for listening. I'll speak to you again next week for another chapter of The Story of London. Bye.